a city was put together, how it worked. The problem that we have is that most of the sites were occupied for thousands of years, so it's very difficult to find a picture of a site at one time. You dig over here, it's third millennium, over here it's the second millennium. They're not part of the same city. The other thing is that I wanted to think about Mesopotamia within a more kind of theoretical framework. Bruce Trigger has talked about complex societies as being either territorial states, places like Egypt, which are very top-down, or city-states, and the Mesopotamia would fall in the city-states. And so one of the things that I wanted to get a better understanding of was how a city-state might have worked, how it was kind of put together. So in territorial states, like the Inca, the centers tend to be very much focused on a kind of central authority. And mostly you would have had elites living there with their servants and slaves and people like that. And the peasants would all be out in the countryside. These were in areas where agricultural land is permanent. So places like Egypt, where you have the wonderful floods that just renew it every year, or perhaps the areas near the mountains of Peru, these are places where it's very difficult for people to run away. If you're part of a larger society and you don't like it, they've got all the land. And so you don't have someplace where you can run away to. And so what we find is the cities there are really kind of elite enclaves. They're going to have servants, they're going to have people who take care of them, but they don't have large population centers, with most of the people now living in the countryside. Now, city-states are not like that. So they're in places where agricultural land comes and goes. And so, for example, we have two things we can talk about. In Mesoamerica, we find areas where you have slash and burn agriculture. That is, that you're going to not chop down the trees, slash the vegetation. You can grow crops for a few years, perhaps 10 years, and then you need to let it go back to being woodland, and you'll open up another area. And in many ways, Mesopotamia is somewhat like that, because when you cultivate in Mesopotamia over long term, salts built up in the soils. And so the areas that you once irrigated are now no longer fertile, and you need to kind of open up new canals, let the salts kind of essentially blow away in the wind, and start all over again. So what you're looking at here is a picture of the old city of Aleppo, and then a plan of a Yoruba city in Nigeria. These are very far apart from each other, but I think they have a lot in common. One of the things that we see is that in cities like this, which are not very hierarchical, that do not have great separations between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. Instead, what we see is the institutions are kind of scattered around the city. They're not all in a clump in the middle. And elites and non-elites tend to live with each other. And they also have a certain amount of social mobility, so people kind of go up and down within the social system to a certain extent. Among the Yoruba who still live in city-state societies, you have the very large cities, and markets are very important, but so is the palace. However, the shrines are on the outside, and everybody lives in the city. So even if you might spend most of your life actually in the countryside where your farm is, if anything important happens, you have a house in town that you make sure that you're there on the right day. The Yoruba, interesting, they have a king, but he's so surrounded by taboos he can't go anywhere. Nobody can see the soles of his feet or his face or much of anything else, so he doesn't get out of the palace. Instead, the people who really matter are the Council of Chiefs. These represent all of the neighborhoods, so that they're living with the people and they represent the people under those circumstances. And this is a society where social mobility is very high. So the question is, how can we see this archaeologically? What are we looking for when we're trying to figure out whether what's going on with the early civilizations that we like to study? My feeling is that when we look at the large cities that we have in Mesopotamia, and the texts, which especially in the second millennium suggest that the Mesopotamians had a certain amount of agency, I think we're dealing with city-states. We know that they were sometimes unified into larger political groups, but then they would fall back again afterwards into the individual cities. Now, the problem is, you know, what I wanted to know is, what do cities that are associated with city-states look like? And one of the problems that we have, and you see that, I think, in this plan of Uruk, is that many of these cities were occupied for thousands of years. And so if you dig over here, you've got something of one date. Dig over there, you've got something of another date. And so what I wanted to do was to find a site that was occupied for a very short period of time, but was still urban. I wanted to be able to identify where the palace was, where the temple was, what was going on in terms of how all of this was kind of playing out within the geography. We also know from excavations at Ur and elsewhere that many farmers lived in the cities, and they would walk out to their fields and then come back. And at Ur, they have excavated multiple neighborhoods, and indeed I'll talk later because we've done a little bit more there. And what you see is a lot of similarity. So the darker the blue, the larger the house, but so that every neighborhood has got small houses, medium-sized houses, and large houses. And so they all seem to be mixed. So this was all information that we had. So what I wanted to do was to find, as I think I've said, a large urban site. So it needed to be big, because I wanted a city, but that was occupied for a very short period of time. And I wanted it to date preferably to the early second millennium, the old Babylonian period, Esinlasa period, because that's when we expect to find private documents in houses that give us additional information on the population as a whole. And there were two. There are several thousand sites that have been surveyed, but only two of them were big, short-term, and dated to the right time period, and those are marked with stars over here. So my first choice was actually the one in the south, and I had it down there. It was near the Euphrates, and we couldn't get there because it was all flooded, which suggested that maybe it wasn't going to be a great place to work. So that didn't pan out, so we really needed the other one. And so we tried to find it. You know, all we have is a dot on a map, and putting that together with a modern landscape is always difficult. First of all, we just had that little car, so we did not have four-wheel drive. We headed in the direction, and we started running into sand dunes, and we're rather worried about being completely lost in the desert, so we turned back, tried another route, and then we realized it was the other side of this marsh, so that wasn't going to work very well. And finally, we got there. So it took a while, and it was really perfect. Occupied for about 150 years, dating to the old Babylonian period, we could see traces of walls on the surface of the site, and it was littered with objects. In fact, I kept on thinking, leave them there, don't pick them up, leave the objects on the ground in this first trip, because I wanted to kind of get a sense of where they came from. Don't pick them up and put them in your pocket, it's not going to work very well. It actually turned out to be even better. We had two short seasons and then one long season, and then Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and that was the end of it. But in the second season, by which time we were beginning to kind of say, what city could this be? What city do we know about in Mesopotamian records that would be kind of in this kind of area, occupied for this kind of time, and that we don't know where it is? My epigraph of the time, Pyotr Steinkeller, said, well, what about Mashkan Shapir? And so we were saying, yes, Mashkan Shapir, that seems like a good idea. Now, one of the things we knew about Mashkan Shapi was it had a city wall, and I hadn't really explored the edges of the site yet. So one day I thought, well, I should probably trace the city wall. We did have a gate, so we probably had it, so I traced it around. And all of a sudden, there were all of these texts lying on the ground. These are dedicatory texts, and about the third piece I picked up, the one I'm pointing to right there, said Mashkan Shap. We knew that it was Mashkan Shapi. This complicated article we had written saying that it ought to be Mashkan Shapi could be thrown away, but we had a name for the site, which was all very nice. This was located on the ancient Tigris. So unlike most Mesopotamian cities, which would tend to be on the Euphrates, on the Tigris, so the arrows are pointing, the arrows further north are pointing to where the ancient Tigris was, and the arrows further south are pointing to the site itself. This is on the satellite imagery that was available at the time, which was actually French spot imagery and Landsat imagery. Here are some of these texts that we found on the surface of the site, which provide us with the name, and also, it clarifies the fact that Mashkan Shapi was very much tied with the city of Lhasa further south, and in some ways they were kind of two capitals of a kingdom there. So what do we do in terms of, so here's a site in the middle of the desert, long way away from everywhere. How does one deal with it? So for the first season, we borrowed the dig house at Abu Salabik. The British liked to suffer a little bit, so it was fairly primitive. And it was also a pretty horrible drive to the site, because Abu Salabik is within the irrigation district. And the other thing was our Land Rover had a slightly wider wheelbase than most of the cars that people were driving. So we'd be driving over these little makeshift bridges over irrigation canals, and the edges of them would kind of fall off. And so I don't think we were very popular, as we had to keep changing routes as we destroyed the bridges. Laundry was in the canal. Paul was doing photography with sunlight, with a goat's head. I'm not quite sure what that was doing there. So it was all, but we had a wonderful time. We had a great season. We were there for 3 weeks. That was the permit I was given. So I wanted to dig some completely no-name site, and they said, well, all right, you can dig there for 3 weeks, but after that, you've got to do salvage in the north. We did our 3 weeks. We weren't helped by the weather. This was a little later in the year than one probably wants to work there. The site's in the middle of the desert. So sometimes we would be kind of blown off the site and feel we had to get to the Land Rover pretty quickly and beep on it to make sure people didn't wander off into the desert in the wrong direction. We weren't able to do quite as much as we wanted. Our excavations would fill up with sand under those circumstances overnight. But we found, I think, 350 objects on the bit of the site that we walked around. So it was very productive. We still didn't have a lot of money the second season, so we did a Christmas season. We were able to rent a house in a village nearby, that made the commute much easier. So there we are. And then the third season, we rented what we thought was a house for the long term. It was a really nice house, had a lovely garden, and had a really good workroom, so we could all kind of work in a really nice space. Then Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait after that, so that was the end of that. And I don't know what happened to all our furniture and everything we left in it, but it was a nice house. We still had a few dust storms that we had to deal with. The site was still in the desert, so that didn't change very much. We had to drive off the Iraqi military, who had decided that our site was just the place to, they kind of put a little man on the top of the temple, and our site was just the place to do some maneuvers. We arrived and realized that metal detecting wasn't going to be very good because it had all this metal on it. And then the next day, the army themselves showed up and told us to go away. And we went beetling up to Baghdad and said, we have this problem. And what was really nice was the head of antiquities said, no, they have a problem. I have redlined the site. I have told them not to go there. long since. And so we went back down and it was explained to them and they packed it up away and they left. So we got rid of the Iraqi army before anybody else did, actually. And we had a good three-month season. We expected to come back the next year, but then Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and that was the end of that. So what did we do? We did the kinds of things that archaeologists tend to do. We put together a contour map. Is this pointing? It's not working. Maybe I can't do it. The three mounds of the red things at the top that are high are late. So those are late mounds on top of it. Everything else is going to be early second millennium. One of the things we wanted to do was get an aerial view of the site. And so Paul actually was the one who was mostly flying the kite. He would kind of walk across the site, towing the kite, and he would just kind of take photographs. This is, of course, of the old days of just basic cameras. So you just put in a timer, and it would go clunk, clunk, clunk until it ran out of film. Not the way we would do it now, but everything has changed. In order to be able to map from it, we painted Pachuras white and put crosses on the ground every 50 meters so that we could then begin to do some mapping. And we could use these to start, we really got into kind of in the ground floor of what we call GIS, but I think you called SIG, in terms of computerized mapping and things like that. But we had to learn how to do that for that. We had some problems with the local fauna. You would have thought you'd be okay in the desert. The camels would eat the flags. And they always bit off the bit that had, it didn't matter what color, and they would go along a row. They'd bite a bit off, and they'd spit it out, and they'd go to the next one, and spit it out, and go to the next one. And then the wild boar would come out at night, and they would dig up the flags looking for the roots, which, of course, they didn't have. So you would have thought in the desert things would have been a little easier. However, we were able to sketch surface features that we saw, and we measured in where we found objects, and we found a lot of them, and we're able to combine the two sources of data. We originally planned on doing some surface scraping. This had been done at the site of Abu Salabik very well, and they were able to kind of recover relatively large amounts of plans, but in some ways we felt we didn't have to do that because we had baked brick foundations on the surface. We could do a little sweeping and we could get whole building plans in some cases. And we did do some excavations. We started off doing small soundings in the early seasons, and we had one kind of final larger season with one larger excavation, which gave us some good information, especially at this point we were able to get a flotation machine going so we could get plant remains, animal remains, get a broader understanding of the economy. And then much to our surprise, it turned out that the flotation machine was also a very good way of finding unbaked clay ceilings. Those are kind of tend to be very, very small pieces of clay. You're not going to really see them when the dirt's on them. They're hard enough that they go through the water without too much trouble. And so we came back to the house one day, and there was our botanist saying, "Look what I found." It had a whole load of unbaked clay ceilings. So that was a kind of an additional benefit. We processed a ton of pottery. This is before the discard pile got large and before the dig house backlog got large either. We would never have been able to process it all if we didn't spend most of our time doing survey. That is, we excavated early and then did survey and caught up with the pottery for the rest of the season. We've excavated at other places in Iraq we'll be talking about, or we've never found pottery in the same kind of quantities that we found it here, and I don't really know what that was all about, but it was a little worrying. We found a very large number of objects. I mean, one of the amazing things about the site is because it was just kind of sitting out there, for so long with wind erosion, it just had objects scattered all over the surface. And those actually turned out to be, as you'll see a little later, very good to help us understand how it was together. So these were all drawn, and then Paul photographed them all. We brought in a geomorphologist who was able to do some drilling in order to understand the canals. And the guy who's actually doing the drilling was great. He was a star center of the Brown University American football team. So he was really strong, and he was the only person who could kind of punch the auger down into the ground. In fact, at one time he broke it. Or rather, because the soil was very, very hard. But so that was. I mean, he was a good archaeologist too, I want to say, but his muscles were also very, very useful. So here's when we got back. This is very, very early. In order to get our plans into the computer, we had to use these kind of boards where you trace them all, and then they would trace into the computer. It was very, very early kind of computerized mapping that we did. But this allowed us to take the aerial photographs and put geographic coordinates on them so that we could really have a kind of a complete image of the surface of the site, and then overlay on that the objects and the materials that we had collected from and the notes that we had done from our work on the surface, so we could combine the two. This is now par for the course for what archaeologists do, but at the time it was fairly new and wonderful. At least we thought it was wonderful. So what have we accomplished? I think, first of all, Mashkan Shapi was a fairly typical Mesopotamian site. About the same size as Ur, a little bit smaller than Nippur. It was big. It was in that kind of urban Mesopotamian category. So that was fine. Other sites have certainly had water courses flowing through them. I think we had a better sense of what was going on because it was so low and everything was so clear. So it was divided into a number of sectors by canals, so there's six parts of it. And then it also had two harbors, so places where boats could come. And once we knew it was Mashkan Shapi, one of the things we knew was it was important for intercity trade. And was associated with the Tigris River. And the arrows are pointing to the two harbors, which are really quite obvious on this. This is a spot satellite image. It could be a Landsat. I can't remember. But those were the images that were available at the time. It was surrounded by a city wall. We identified at least two gates there. I'm sure there were more. And then there was also another gate where a canal came through, so the other places where the canals would come through the walls, so that we were able to identify that. And then there were roads that we could see crossing the city. These were kind of obvious because people threw trash in them, and so they were long, linear areas of dense potsherds. Because of the ways things worked. Once we traced the roads, we could then have a sense of the way people would go across the canals. In some cases, as in the photograph you have here, we actually had kind of brick foundations on both sides, but we don't really know whether that was just for a ferry boat that went past or if they had something like a pontoon bridge or something that went over the canal. But there would be crossing points across each canal that would tie the city together. And we found 1,400 objects on the surface of the site. So that was a large number of objects, and these really allowed us to begin to get an understanding of the different types of activities that took place here and there. So the southernmost part of the site was the area that was the center for religion. It was the one place where we had much of any topography, and we could see the bricks which would have supported the temple. So you would have had a brick platform. All we have left is the brick, but we have that. One of the things that was fairly typical for this particular time period was to have terracotta statuary kind of decorating the entrances to the temple, and we had it too. I actually was looking for the edge of the site when I stumbled into this kind of pile of bits and pieces of terracotta statuary. So we have humans, there's a life-size foot. The head is less than life-size, so some were life-size and some were not. We also had a life-size horse, and this is the only terracotta horse that I know about from Mesopotamia. And lions were fairly typical. You can see the two lions at Tel Harmel, where they've been reconstructed. So we would have just had not just two lions, but a whole kind of menagerie, presumably, in the entrance as you went into the temple. But it's only at Tel Harmel where we really have a couple of other places where we have a good sense of how it all works. This particular part of the site was perhaps administrative. The southwestern part of the site would have been where the temple was, so this would have been relatively close to that. And we had excavations. We found a fair number of tablets here. This is where we found most of the stuff. You can see the excavations. The other thing we found in large numbers here are model chariots, and we don't entirely know what model chariots do. Many of them have this particular design on them. This is the person who's inside the thing, so it's not really, I don't think it's a shield for other people to look at. It's the person who's actually supposed to be in the tablet. This is the god Shamash, who is the sun god. But we had, and we had many of them that were his. But he's also related to Nergal, the god of the underworld, who was the god of Mashkan Shapir, and we found a whole bunch with his symbols as well. The sickle that you see there is because he's the god of death, and so he can kind of reap, presumably, and kill people in the process. And so these two were counterparts, and I think we have to assume that there would have been temples to, the main temple would have been to Nergal, but perhaps there was a secondary temple to Shamash, given that we're getting this kind of iconography. We also found ceilings. So unbaked clay ceilings would be found, and they're indications of administrative activity. Many of them were door ceilings, so you would essentially kind of tie a door closed and then put a piece of clay on top of it, roll your cylinder seal on that, and that way, so long as it was all intact when you came back, nobody had gotten into your room, and if they did get in the room, they had to break it. And of course, every time you wanted to get into the room, you had to break it and you left it on the floor, and that's how we found these. But this kind of indicated that the building that we were excavating was perhaps administrative, at least in some kind, although it certainly had domestic features. It had bread ovens and things with it as well. So the presence of ceilings in this and what we could see, fairly regular architecture in the kite photographs that we had, so made us think for a while that maybe this is where the palace was located. I wasn't particularly happy about that because I basically thought palaces should be a long way away from the temple, and this was rather close to it. And what we're looking at here is a really huge palace at Mari. I didn't think ours was going to be quite as big. But when we excavated it, it really turned out to be just domestic architecture. So that was fine. It had some burials in it. And those are generally below the floors of the houses, including adults. And then these are all babies. And this is a fairly common thing to find in Mesopotamian sites, rooms with pots full of dead babies. But then neonates probably didn't survive very easily under the kind of more primitive situation of the past. The other thing we found, though, as I said, is we found lots of unbaked ceilings, which we found through flotation primarily. And these are indicative of kind of administrative activity. But you have a kind of a map of where these all came from, and you can see that they pretty much all of the buildings had some of them in this particular area. Now, there is a canal that would be going in the southeast so that they would have been pretty close to a canal. And so it may be that these buildings, even though they're domestic, were also storing up goods and packaging them for in order to, for them to be shipped. This is what they look like. So the back of them is going to show you what they were stuck onto. Some of them were on doors, and some of them looked to be on kind of bundles and things. And then the front of them is going to show the impression of somebody's cylinder seal that they would have rolled over in order to kind of take control over it. Another thing that we found a lot of was impressed bitumen. So bitumen is natural asphalt, it's a good waterproofing material. And so it looked as though some of the things that they may have been shipping out, they had kind of wrapped up in reeds, in kind of bundles, and then plastered bitumen asphalt all over it for waterproofing before they stuck it in a boat to send it somewhere else. That's at least the best thought that we can have about that stuff. We did find a couple of tablets. The round one is where somebody was testing a new stylus. They didn't really say much of anything. And the other one is a list of boat shipments, which was at least comforting since we thought we were dealing with boat shipments. But we didn't find a lot of written material. So although once we'd done the excavations, we could say, okay, this is a well laid out material area, but this is certainly not the palace. We knew there was a palace at Mashkan Shapir, so that was a little disturbing. We didn't really find it when we were there. However, more recently, high-resolution satellite imagery has become available, and people have begun to irrigate all the way around Mashkan Shapir. So it's no longer in the middle of the desert, it's the middle of a cultivated zone. This raised the saline water table, and suddenly you can see a large amount of architectural traces on the surface of the site because the salts concentrate over the more dense walls and they don't concentrate over the rooms. And that includes what you see here and the very northern part of the site, as far away from the temple as possible, where I think we are pretty sure that we have a not particularly big palace, but a palace nevertheless. And it certainly has includes within it the standard aspect of having a square courtyard leading through two doors into a rectangular throne room. So that's what palaces have, and that's what we can see in this particular satellite image. We've also identified the cemetery. The cemetery was walled off from the rest of town, so it had a wall around it, we're basically identifying it because the looters have identified it long since and have been kind of digging lots of holes in it. But what were they, people would have been buried in these large jars, they were scattered around, and so were a fairly large number of the grave goods that would have been associated with them, such as cylinder seals, weapons, and things like that. So we had a real concentration of surface objects in that particular area. The wall around the site was visible in the aerial photographs. Here you see some of them have been stitched together, like colored them for some reason. And so this matches, obviously, the text that talked about building the city wall of Mashkan Shapir, even though the wall itself is not necessarily always very easy to see on the surface. And we could also kind of get a sense of what was going on with manufacturing. Along the main street that goes across, the green dots are copper workshops. So it looks as though you had a main road going through the middle of the town that, among other things anyway, would have a whole bunch of copper workshops going along with it. You have a couple of copper workshops in the northern part of the site as well, but they're mostly concentrated along there. Where you can see kind of red and yellow, those are going to be areas of smokestack industries, and they're going to be in the leeward part of the site because the wind would be coming from the northwest. The other thing they were doing is they were manufacturing artificial basalt. This had been actually, people had been finding pieces of it for a long time, but because they were manufacturing it here, we were able to identify it. So here's a big chunk of this stuff. What they're doing, I had a wonderful guy from who melted rocks for a living at Stony Brook, and he had a happy time melting the little samples that we had. What they're basically doing to make this is they're taking perfectly ordinary Mesopotamian clay and treating it like a metal. So they're putting it in a furnace, but it's a huge furnace. So it's being heated without any to very high temperatures with no access to oxygen. And you wind up with a material which is very, very much like basalt. So a volcanic stone, which you can use for grinding stones. People had been finding this material in Mesopotamian sites for years. Everybody now says, oh yes, at this particular period, all the grinding stones are made out of this material. But it's only because in the temple, I think they must have made the floor out of it, nice black floor for the god of death, I suppose, that we had large enough pieces that we could say, wait a minute, this is not natural. And then we could have the analysis done and could show them. Also, for manufacturing, they had a certain number of kind of small grinding stones, probably to make stone bowls. And then we had lots of terracottas. This is very typical for the early second millennium in Mesopotamia. We had plenty of them, of various kinds and shapes. We assume that these were both kind of decorative and religious, some combination of the two. We were able to think about the distribution of wealth. So, you know, one of the questions always is, do you have rich people living over here and poor people living over here? One of the main imported materials that would have been very valuable in Mesopotamia would have been copper bronze. We collected every little bit of copper bronze on the surface of the site, and we could kind of map it, which is what you're seeing here, and basically it was everywhere. So we can't say that one area had more access to bronzes than others. Another status item would be cylinder seals. We found a bunch of those on the surface of the site. And again, we found them pretty much everywhere. The one place we don't find very much is where the temple is, but that's probably because there's been a great deal of erosion of the high temple mound that has kind of covered up other kinds of things. So overall, basically what we're seeing is considerable equality over the site. It was divided into sectors by the canals. The temple and Paris were and palace were separated. Smokestack industries were in the leeward part of the site. And the major roads either paralleled the canals or went across them, and there must have been bridges or ferries that would have ferried you across at those various crossing points. So this is kind of an artist's drawing that we were given for the site. She got tired of drawing houses, however. It's rather depopulated, and there's rather too much water there, so you have to adjust it a little bit. So since that time, the desert has been irrigated, and we now have high-resolution satellite imagery that we can take a look at, and that makes a bit of a difference. And then also since that time, the site has been looted. This has happened to most of the Mesopotamian sites. So here you can see the difference between it before and afterwards. All the kind of dark stuff is looting. Okay, so in conclusion, I want to argue that I think this particular project has given us the best information that we have on the organization of a Mesopotamian city, and all of a Mesopotamian city. We've got lots of excavations elsewhere, but we tend to know a lot of this bit and that bit and that bit, but not all of it. I also think that the physical separation of the temple and palace really suggests that these were competing institutions, and that they each had their own part of the city, and perhaps their own people. I think the similarity in the patterns of architecture that we've been able to see, especially when we got the high-resolution satellite imagery later on, suggests very little differentiation between different parts of the site. And I think that that's going to be something which is of interest in many ways in terms of the way that Mesopotamian society worked. Thank you.